No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. This week we have we're going to start out the show with what I think is one of the more interesting guests we've had in a while. His name is Russell Hirschhorn, and he's running for president with a kind of a unique slant. But we'll bring him on in a minute. Let me say hello to my co-host, Maria. How are you?
Michael, it's great to be speaking with you from the left coast.
I'm doing well.
Doesn't get much bluer than California. I guess maybe D.C. and New York, right? But
yeah.
It's an interesting time for me because I have so many friends that are Democrats, and I mean dear friends. And then there's my fiscal conservative leanings. And we're so alike in so many ways because I'm very liberal socially. I was at a wedding last night and our local assembly member was there with her husband, I consider her a friend first, a Rotarian city council member and now assembly member. And she always looks at me and she goes, Maria, you know you've got the wrong initial after your name. So we always have it's respectful, it's kind, it's intellectually stimulating, and it's nice. So unlike a lot of folks who can't have a decent conversation with somebody who has different views, we get heated, but it never gets discourteous or ugly. And I just really think that's the solution to a lot of what's going on in our country.
Well, I agree with that. And I got to tell you, I came from just the opposite place this weekend where I went to Pennsylvania to a beautiful little town called Kennett Square to celebrate my father-in-law's birthday. And up there, they were mostly conservative Republicans. And lots of Trump supporters. Now, we avoided the subject. Because it's family, and I would say that half of my wife's family is very liberal, and I would say the other half is very conservative. So since it was G-Pop's birthday, we didn't really get into it. But again, we have very respectful discussions, and I think you're right. I think that my dad used to say, you can never learn anything new from somebody that agrees with you.
So you should always listen.
You really have to listen to the other side. Well, that's the perfect segue to bring Russell Hirschhorn on. Is he there? Do we have Russell with us?
I believe so. And then let our listeners know, after our conversation with Russell, which, Russell, I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Michael and I, the senator, and I are going to go through the top news stories in the past week because we're bursting with information.
Yeah, bursting with the enthusiasm, if nothing else. Russell, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, well, great. You sound great. And thanks so much for being on the show. Russell is running for president of the United States and has a somewhat unique platform. and a really great slogan, which is Make America Sane Again. And the reason that he wants to make America sane again is because we're spending over $2 billion, that's $2 billion with a B, on this presidential election. And Russell seems to have it in his head that feeding people and providing clean water and taking care of some other priorities might make more sense. So I don't want to explain your position, Russell. You do it, okay? Why are you doing all this?
Well, it really is just a campaign to ask people the question, exactly what you had said a moment ago, whether we need $2 billion to elect the next president. In 2012, it was $2.6 billion. For the presidential election campaign cycle. And while I don't know if it'll reach that height this time, we're certainly headed towards $2 billion. And I think you know, potentially some campaign finance reform is in order. But my campaign goal is just to ask people to ask themselves whether they should give to a charitable organization instead of a political campaign. And we're coming down to the election date in November, and enormous amounts of money are going to be spent to try and sway voter preference in the last 30 days or so, and in the swing states. It's a lot of money.
So, Russell, can you give us a brief history about your political aspirations and your resume or CV, if you will?
Well, the aspirations politically really, I would say, don't exist in other than trying to kind of awaken, I think, a slumbering public as they go through the process of seeing campaign ads, of receiving information from candidates, of moving and hoping for political change. What I try and do is use performance art to try and affect certainly what they may be thinking, but to awaken them. And often it does, because if you've been in Washington, D.C. or in Los Angeles lately, you may have driven by me sitting on a commode, a toilet, in public, wearing a suit, reading a newspaper. And it's interesting in that it gets different reactions. And when I say different reactions, the fact that they don't react at all to me is a reaction. I think that's a pretty interesting statement on the general public. And other times people are just extremely curious of what I'm doing. And at that point, we kind of put forth our message, and that of which it's a campaign to kind of steer people's thought processes towards donating in a different manner.
What an interesting idea, huh, Russell, to try to use political campaigns to make a better world instead of trying to use political campaigns for your own benefit. I admire you for doing that, because right?
I mean, it is pie in the sky, and you can it can be taken with a grain of salt, because honestly, we work within a system that ideally, as a democracy, filters and puts forth candidates that the people as a whole choose, and that's the beauty of America. But I think it's important that, from a creative standpoint, that we interject different ideas in different ways, and that's also what, because if I did what I'm doing here in some of the other countries, I might get beaten and thrown in the jail for a month or two.
I live in Los Angeles, and I haven't heard of your antics. So that, are you not that, getting? That
Apparently not. Apparently, I'm not getting the media hits. But we had an enormous 4-day span of activities in Los Angeles, where we flew in, stopped by a home supply store, picked up a very efficient toilet mechanism, and then drove to Venice Beach and put it actually within 100 feet of the police substation on a nice little mound there, and sat on it. And that garnered a huge reaction. I would say at least 100 or so people interacted within the 20 minutes we were there. And that was fantastic. And at the same time, we were putting forth our messaging. And then we went up to Malibu later, Pacific Coast Highway, and Webb Avenue, and also to set on a toilet there on the median. And then we appeared at the Malibu Pier, and then we went down to the Pacific Palisades for an amazing photo shoot with Jennifer Cawley, who is an amazing Los Angeles photographer, and she put forth a very compelling photograph for us on the beach.
Well, let me ask you, who finances this for you? How do you pay for this? Because it's not cheap to fly to L.A. That's why I don't get to see Maria more.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
if you carefully plan your flight, reservations, I was able to get out there for a little over $310. So that I could afford, and then stayed at a friend's apartment, which was very generous of them. And so the only expenses really were the airfare and that's the beauty. I mean, for me, this is important. So we don't accept contributions. We allow people to give to charities that are important to myself or to give to their own charities and embrace that just as much.
So are you going to be a write-in candidate, or have you pulled papers and gotten signatures and you're actually going to be on the ballot?
So the presidential campaign is not about getting elected for me. That is up to other individuals. But for me, this is a presidential campaign which is dedicated to focusing on potentially campaign finance reform, but more importantly, asking individuals to give to charitable organizations rather than political campaigns. So it's my goal is not one of achieving a single vote. It's certainly not one of receiving a single dollar, but it's just asking, I just hoping that people just look at this and say, you know, how many votes are going to make up the swing state difference in the five or so, I believe, five states that will be important to that will decide the election? How much money do we have to spend on that? And will it be for providing buses to get people, you know, is this going to be a gigantic transportation fund project? Literally. I mean, literally, it could come down to campaigns planning how they will get people from A to B to the polling places. I mean, could be the election right there. So all I'm asking is that they consider how they donate their money. It's a very passionate election. I don't think there's one individual from the Trump campaign that is going to switch to the Hillary Clinton campaign. I don't think there's going to be one Clinton person that switches to the Trump campaign, no matter how many dollars you throw at it. It's just not going to happen. What it's going to be is turnout.
You make a really good point here, Russell, that what, you know, when you're talking about $2 billion and you're talking about the electorate in general, there is a core a group of Trump supporters and Hillary supporters, which make up the vast majority of the electorate. So all of this money, this $2 billion, is really spent on this small, undecided minority that may actually make the difference. You know, I mean, I don't want to make it sound unimportant because it's very important to the candidates. But yeah, you're really not talking about swaying most of America, because most of America has already been swayed, one or at least
exactly.
The electorate,
I haven't seen a Hillary or Trump sign in Washington, because they know which way it's going.
Right.
But if you live in Florida or Ohio, I bet the airwaves and the streets are covered with informational branding for the candidates. But I also think those organizations are gearing up for a strategic mobilization of the individuals. But that's, you know, how they do that and what they do. I mean, I'm not about one candidate or the other. I'm thrilled we live in a democracy, but I am about asking ourselves, you know, how much money is required, you know, where that money comes from, and as individuals, how we can help people and do better with the funds we have.
And I'm wondering if that $2 billion figure includes all the free publicity that Trump generates.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
So it's hard dollars, huh?
Yeah, that's hard dollars.
And it's the quality, you know, Russell and I talked earlier, and it's also the quality of the messaging. If you've seen, if you've seen the Trump ads or the Hillary ads, they really, what do they really say? I mean, if Trump gets elected, the world will be great and everything will be perfect. If Hillary gets elected, Hillary needs to get elected because she believes in this or that. I mean, they're really, it really, in my opinion, doesn't provide the substance that you need to make a decision, an intelligent decision on which candidate you want to back, you know. Reading the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, or listening to new, maybe listening to hard news about the candidates, that, which also obviously takes up a lot of time, seems to me to be a better way to get information than political ads anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. When was the last 30-second ad that had any real meaning make a difference? I just don't think it exists.
They throw out these taglines and that's about it.
Well, to that note, you guys, though, one just as an aside, which Michael, I'll speak with you at the second half of the program, but the Harvard Business School releases an annual report since 2012, and they're saying that they're placing on why the United States has made virtually no progress to reclaim our position in the global marketplace is because of our broken political system. And they're saying they use the term castigating both candidates for widening the political chasm. This is from Harvard. Yeah. So,
and isn't there a natural, in what Russell is talking about, isn't there a natural tendency to do that, right? You're putting two teams. You're putting a team of liberal consultants and a team of conservative consultants, a team of Republican consultants, a team of Democratic consultants against each other. And I mean, it has a natural tendency to do that, right? I want to gain the most ground for my candidate, and the other side wants to gain the most ground for their candidate. And in so doing, I mean, there's no compromising in campaigns. In fact, that's one of the basic rules. I train people, and I ran against a guy one time, did very well against him, would say in debate, he would say, well, I agree with Senator Brown that we should. And, you know, in campaign school, we would say, never say that. Never say I agree with my opponent.
Right.
Even if you agree with him, you know. And so there's kind of a natural tendency, just by the nature of the whole thing, to make that chasm wider, I think. What do you think, Russell?
I think this has been the most divisive campaign I've seen in a while. It's It's worrisome. You know, regardless if you're a Democrat or Republican, I don't think the inherent belief is that we are looking for a divided country. I think there's a hope that as a group we can focus. Unfortunately, sometimes it happens in dedicated wartime where we all come together. But in a non-time of war, the individuals seem to pull to themselves and say, now it's time to focus on my own desires and needs, and here's the candidate that's going to do it. And then the rhetoric becomes extremely volatile. It is extremely saddening, especially when we all have friends overseas, and we get phone calls, and they say, "What the heck's happening? How is this? How can you guys, out of 300 plus million people, have two individuals with such controversial backgrounds? This is the best of the best."
Everybody's saying, "This is the best we can do."
Yeah, and that, you know, is really the issue at hand, isn't it? Is that the political system is broken, and you're right, Maria. People want to bring it back together, but they're just not sure how to do it. And to have a divisive campaign like this, I agree. But I want
to
ask.
Okay, go ahead, Michael. Okay.
Tell us about your previous campaigns, because I know this. Well, you're an old hat at this.
Senator, you never would have seen me in this political landscape had it not been for the scenario we're having in this election. I was more than happy to remain quiet. But back in 1990, I ran for mayor of D.C., and I was also an active performance artist. And as a performance artist, I was able to do things that were completely unusual, sometimes in front of a large group of individuals, sometimes a very small group of individuals, but it was always meant to incite a reaction. People would see what I did, and they would either be shocked, horrified, or entertained, depending on the actual act. And at 1990, we had a large number of homicides in Washington, D.C., and I felt compelled, after the news cycle was focused not only on Mayor Barry's activities, but the fact that the news cycle focused specifically on his drug behavior versus the fact that a 15-year-old child had been shot in the head, and it made Nea a ripple. It had become just so commonplace. And I thought, if this is the climate that we're living in, then I can interject myself from a performance artist political perspective and potentially change the topic of conversation. I don't know if I was effective at doing that, but I followed the campaign through. It was a learning experience myself, and it was, I think, entertaining for many. My posters found themselves all over the city, the conscious choice for an unconscious world with a characterized face of myself from a photograph. And if you saw it, you'd be like, that is the silliest campaign poster ever. But that was the enjoyment of it. The enjoyment of putting up a non-traditional campaign poster for me is the best thing ever. And so I followed that campaign, and I thought, what's next after that? Well, we'll run for president. So in 92, I ran for president, and the campaign posters were also very entertaining as well. Absolute Mayor, I think I was draped in a flag, and that was based on an Absolute Vodka ad. The conscious choice for an unconscious world, in which I was sitting on the toilet, and I was, the White House was superimposed in the background, and we're sitting on K Street, and people took the posters and appreciated them. And at that time, it was about getting the youth vote out. It's about kind of interacting with the disenfranchised younger generation. Did some unofficial things with MTV, was at both conventions, Republican and Democratic, and I mean, just amazing times. We my girlfriend, soon to be wife, Jennifer, went with me to Houston. The park rangers gave us a demonstration space. We had reserved it, and it
really
was capable of holding, it was capable of holding about 10,000 people. It was a platform. They gave me a microphone, and nobody were in the field. It was just us with the toilet with Gatorade in the back of it. And I was sitting on it, and all I could say through the microphone was, you know, good morning, President Bush. And the park police would bring up the media. And my mother didn't find out I was in Houston until it was on the front page of the Washington Times. And,
I like your new slogan, but I like your old slogan, too. I looked it on YouTube, and I encourage people to go to YouTube and look at some of Russell's commercials, because they're very interesting. And there was one that really captured my interest that said, vote or I might just win. That was seemed to be the, you know, to get out to do get out the vote stuff. Vote or you could end up with a guy like me instead of, you know, a serious person. And I think, again, your ability to make us look at the process from a different angle, I think that's really valuable. All kidding aside, I really do.
The irony was what happened in Florida.
Russell, how come you're not getting more traction? Are you not promoting yourself on social media?
He's a $1 billion short, Maria.
Well, but social media is free.
No, he's dead. Well, hey, look, I want to just say, before you answer that question, Russell, I looked on your Twitter account, and I see that James Zogby, and if you don't know who James Zogby is, he's a super delegate here in Washington, pretty prominent Washingtonian, said that this guy puts a smile on your face, tweeted that out. So you're getting looked at by some powerful people, pal.
Well, it's subjective. You know, we have a Facebook page, Russell Hirschhorn for President. That's a great interface for all the videos. So if you go to that space, you'll see all the LA events in which we did Venice Beach, Pacific Coast Highway, some of the posters we've made, and some of the other items. The website, russell.org, has the overall campaign position. Mm-hmm. And if you go to YouTube, there's the commercial/campaign message for this year as well. The importance, you know, the fact that we're giving, or the fact that over $2 billion was spent in 2012, and asking people to just take a moment to think whether we can use some of their donations for better causes.
Well, I take it from a guy that's been a campaign consultant to several presidential campaigns, some of them who actually won. Let me tell you, Russell, you're doing a good job at this. I mean, I watched your campaign ad, and I can imagine that you didn't have much money to work with, and I thought it was really good. I think it was really well done, and I encourage you to keep this activity up in your life, because I think we really do need people out there in the process making people think about it. You know, just like Jon Stewart and Colbert and those people, you know, nobody takes them seriously, but they have great influence. I think that you can have great influence doing this. I think that, you know, I certainly would say, yeah, on my list of priorities, giving money to crippled children or homeless women or, you know, one of veterans or one of a dozen causes makes more sense to me than one more $25, $50 political contribution, which is not going to amount to a hill of beans in the cosmic scheme of things. So I think I think you're playing a really important role. Maria, do you have one last question for our guest before we let him go? Enjoy the rest of his Sunday.
Russell, the one thing that I would like to say is I like your spirit of altruism. And there's almost an innocent like quality about what you're saying, because you can't argue with you. I would say it's almost awe-inspiring. And so I wish you nothing but good luck. And I will follow you now that I've been on your website, but I didn't want to know a whole bunch because I wanted you to share with us what it is that you're trying to do. And I think you did that eloquently. So thank you.
And let me say, Russell, give us the information we need, our listeners need, to plug in your website one more time.
Okay. The website is russell.org. That's russell.org. You can go on Facebook, Russell Hirshon for President, and you'll see the community there. Or you could just Google Russell Hirshon, and you'll land on one of the various properties. I'm on Twitter. We're on Instagram. And again, there are less than 50 days left, and you can be sure that I'll be working hard to see how we can stir the emotions of people that we interact with. So,
and it's Hirshon is the spelling of your last name, Hirshon.
That's correct. Yep.
And let me also say that maybe. A guy that can figure out how to get to Los Angeles and back to Washington for $310 and do a bunch of PR events. Maybe we should all get together and make sure this guy gets on the ballot next time. Russell, thanks so much for being with us. I hope I get to meet you in person soon.
You will. You will. I'm sure.
And continued success, Russell.
Yeah, again. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to take a short break and play my single favorite campaign song in the history of campaign songs. It's Huey Long's campaign song called Every Man a King. And Maria and I will be back in a couple minutes. Thank you.
Why weep or slumber, America? Land of brave and true. There's castles and clothing and food for all. All belongs to you. Every man a king, every man
Thank you so much for listening to Shadow Politics with your host, Senator Michael Brown, and co-host Maria Sanchez. We're back, and we're going to be talking. We're going to make this more of a regular feature because our program isn't just about politics. It's about what's going on in the news, and there's always lots to share. And so Michael and I thought, well, why don't we, the two of us, he right coast, me left coast, him left-leaning, me right-leaning, he male, me female. We have different points of view sometimes, always respectful, but what went on in the world. So I'm just going to run a few stories past you, Michael, and see which one you'd like to dig into. Last night, 9 were stabbed in a shopping mall at St. Cloud, Minnesota, and terrorists are taking credit for it. A 22-year-old man who was born in Africa, but he's lived in the United States for the last 15 years. 3 are hospitalized, and he was shot dead. Then we have the presidential debate, which has been scheduled for September 26th. Only 2 were invited, the 2 major candidates. We can get into those details. That Sweden rejected the plea from WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to drop the arrest warrant about this 2010 rape case. That the Justice Department is addressing the heroin opioid addiction. That there's 100 deaths a day in the United States, which has quadrupled since 1999. I have 2 friends that lost. One lost his son. He discovered dead on the bathroom floor in his home. The other lost girlfriend lost her daughter dead. Both of them overdoses, accidental. That the Arctic Sea shrank to its summer lowest, which is the second lowest, tied in 2007. 2012 was the lowest ever. The 3rd consecutive year in which the corn farmers will spend more than they'll earn because of the glut of corn and the lower prices. And that Harvard Business School report and giving you politicians, Michael, such responsibility for how we are making no progress in our global marketplace, which I find really interesting, and that sit-down chain restaurants are hurting. They once were 53% of the revenue. Now fast food is 53% of the revenue. And finally, the flu season is almost upon us and what to do and where to go. So I am open to discuss anything, and I know that was a lot.
Well, and might I say you missed some of the big, big stories like the axis of the Earth is changing, so they've changed. So NASA announced this week that they've changed all the dates for the astrological signs. So you might think you're a Libra, but that, you know, that's not necessarily so. Of course,
that missed me.
I'm saying that tongue in cheek because I'm a great believer in superstition. But let's start by talking about what may or may not be 2 terrorist attacks. There's one at the Minnesota Mall, which some group has already taken responsibility for, mm-hmm. a terrorist group, and you mentioned that. And there's also the explosion mm-hmm. in Chelsea, where 29 people were injured, but nobody was killed. In fact, in either attack, I don't think anybody was killed, but many people injured. And we've just found out, I think, that there was also a bomb. There was one bomb in New York that didn't detonate, right. And there was another one in Seaside, New Jersey, which is that's a very scary thing for me because, you know, as a child, I spent a lot of time going to Seaside, and it's a resort. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's like being on the Santa Monica Pier or something. There's a big boardwalk in Seaside, and it's really a family, unless it's changed dramatically over the years, it's really a family resort. It's a place where there's probably more kids than there are adults. So that's very, very, very scary. But what do you say about these things? I don't know what to say. We haven't gotten to the bottom of the New York thing, so we don't know.
Right, because, I know, which I appreciate now, that they try not to release anybody's name, you know, so as not to popularize them, if you will, which they didn't in the St. Cloud story, but somebody dug and found the father who is the one that shared things. And the only one dead in that incident is the stabbing person. I like the fact that we are being more cautious and also trying to keep things as quiet as possible in terms of identification so that you know, as the ISIS asking for lone wolves. Well, some of these folks are answering that, which is what they say they think the St. Cloud issue may have been, just a lone wolf, and that they're now taking credit for it. But apparently, before he stabbed people, he asked them if they were Muslim. So,
well, yeah, look, there's no shortage of nuts in the world. But let me just tell you, since you're kicking politicians a little bit, let me kick journalists a little bit. And that is, you know what drives me crazy?
What?
It drives me crazy when I see something on the news that says the terrorists snuck in this side exit at the airport that has been traditionally unguided. Unguarded, and we found out that 62 of the entrances were malfunctioning. I mean, it's like, why are we giving these guys ideas and a roadmap? You know, it really bothers me when they go into such detail that you know, on the news with some of this stuff, since you mentioned it, that you think to yourself, well, damn, if they didn't think of it before, they're certainly going to think of it now.
Well, it is interesting about the fine line between what do we need to know and what should be not shared because of what you're just suggesting. But then I worry about the filtering that goes on, that like there's a big daddy somewhere deciding about what the little kids can know and not know. That's where I mean, when I had my morning drive radio program and I would prep, I always prep the night before. Then I would prep at 3 a.m. because I wanted to see what happened while I had been asleep. Then I'd prep right before the show started, so in case I missed anything on my drive to the studios. And the same story would have three different points of view. And what? I always said, well, there's only one truth. So what is it? And it would be sometimes it would be minutia, like the person was 5'7", and someone else would say they were 5'9". And, you know, so that's not really important. However, there's only one true answer. The other things that scared me more than that, though, was the facts, which Reuters would have one story, the BBC would have one story, and then USA Today would have one version of the same story. And all I could understand of it is that it boils down to a human being. It was somebody writing the story. And so as humans, we are subject to flaws and we're not always correct. But you'd think that's what the fact checkers are supposed to be doing. There's people who vet those things. So when I saw that on a firsthand basis, on a regular basis, that made me wonder, well, what is true?
Well, and you know, that's the other side of that coin, too, is that in the whole choosing process, as our guest Russell pointed out, you know, when he ran for mayor, that there were 15-year-old kids. I lived here at the time, and there were 15-year-old kids getting shot in the head, and they were on the third page of the Metro section, and the current mayor's drug abuse was on the first page of the Metro section, because that's what... That's what got people's attention. It wasn't that was most newsworthy necessarily, but it's what, you know, it seems to me that more and more, as our country becomes more and more divided, we tend to go for the most salacious details.
Well, I think that's always been true because the adage is, if it bleeds, it leads. But yeah. I had the privilege of seeing the president and CEO of the National Public Radio, Jarl Moyne, M-O-H-N, I believe, speak on Friday night. And he spoke to that about, he said, like some people will say, wait a second, you published 19 Trump stories, but only 12 Clinton stories. How come you're not being fair? And he said, it's not about being fair. It's about what's in the news. And if Secretary Clinton wasn't in the news, and he says, of course, as we know, she hasn't had a press conference for however many days it is now. So, but Clinton isn't making news. It's not that they're being biased or they're being, what would you say, not balanced. It's just that Trump was making more news. And then he mentioned that about other stories. We have to decide what we put in because we don't have a limitless amount of time. So we have to make a choice about what would be most salient to most people. And then that's when he went into the podcasts. They have millions of their broadcasts downloaded via podcast, which our program becomes once we're not live, then it's available for download via a podcast, and how that ends up fueling more of the, if you want to say, listenership, because people get to listen at their luxury on demand instead of when we air, which is what is driving that market now.
Well, far be it from me to disagree with someone so distinguished as this man from NPR, but I would have a question for him, and that is, I went to the Trump victory party in Iowa, and there were, I don't know, maybe 50 TV cameras. At all the other parties, there were, that I went to anyway, I went to Bernie's and I went to Hillary's and I think I went to Martin O'Malley, one other. There were a few cameras. But at Trump, there were three times as many cameras, and the guy was getting his butt kicked by Rubio. At Rubio's party, there weren't nearly as many journalists. And I think so that would be my question to him. Trump was making these outrageous statements at the time, and people were reacting to them. And I think, going back to the thing you said, if it bleeds, it leads. I think they have a responsibility somehow in trying to present a picture that's more even. And I think they're like every other commercial enterprise, they go where the money is. And that doesn't mean that I ever want to see us getting into a position where there are 17 Trump stories and 12 Clinton stories and people are worried about that. I don't think you need to have one Trump story for every Hillary story or every Hillary story for one Trump story. I mean, if one is making news and the other, I understand that. I think that that's perfectly appropriate. But I also think that they tend to want to, play for the ratings.
Well, yes, of course, unfortunately, because that's the bottom dollar. Bottom line is the dollar. But hopefully with integrity, right, and not sensationalism, which both Fox and MSNBC are guilty of doing the latter, not the former, in my estimation. Let's not go into that. That bothers me. I want to get your feeling about this Harvard Business School report. Because it really got my attention. So one of the authors, his name is Michael Porter. He's considered our country's foremost expert on United States competitiveness. So we're not talking about some trifling little piece. It was 102 pages. And here's a direct quote. He says, the course presidential campaign and that both candidates are widening the political chasm by either dumbing things down or making small, like trying to take the big picture and make it smaller. And he's saying that that's the reason that we've lost progress in the global marketplace. I mean, that puts a lot of pressure on you, Michael.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, Maria, that, when we look at the way our country has developed and we look at some of the turning points, how productive we were, for example, during the Second World War. We had this great industry in America that in the United States that instantly turned into manufacturing goods for the war. And that really was the difference in a lot of people's opinions, right? When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, they just didn't have the sense of what how quickly we could turn from a primarily civilian workforce into a military workforce. And that required great cooperation, did it not? I mean, that's how women first entered
the workforce.
In such great numbers is because they stood, they answered the call, basically. They stepped up to the plate and said, okay, we all know Rosie the Riveter. And
they identified her correctly for the first time this week. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did. And I also saw that last week, unfortunately, she passed away, but last week. But they also identified the woman who was in the famous kiss in Times Square At the end of the Second World War with a sailor, we've all seen that picture where the sailor gives this nurse a big kiss. But I think that, you know, I think we have a hard time, and it's hard to put our finger on it. Why we've lost this esprit de corps.
The blame is on a broken political system, saying that it obstructs economic growth and competitiveness. And I don't know if that's because of legislation or taxation. They did come up with a lot of recommendations as to what we should do better, which was lowering the corporate tax index was one of the first things they talked about. But it just made me think about you, because I know you're passionate. I know that you're caring. I know that you're moral. I know that you're ethical. I know that about you as the man that you are. And then to be smudged like this with the broad brush, it sounds kind of cheesy, but these are some of the brightest minds in the world that came up with this conclusion.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I find most intriguing and interesting about politics, is that what a complex web it is. And, you know, the more divisive you get, of course, policy is a part of that. I remember, for example, covering a great piece of policy called the Family Assistance Plan. And the Family Assistance Plan was an idea that Richard Nixon came up with, and that Daniel Patrick Moynihan tried to get through the Senate and was the sponsor of. And so you had this liberal senator and a somewhat conservative president who were pushing for the same thing, and it was a great idea. Most people call it a negative income tax. Never passed, never got through. But the thing that was interesting when you looked at it is who the players were in dividing, you know, in the divisiveness. For example, they wanted to replace welfare programs with a negative income tax. So they would give people money with the idea that consumers know best how to spend their own money. Well, you would think that all the people on the welfare side would be for this. It would really help welfare beneficiaries. But a lot of them weren't, because it was dismantling the system that already existed of things like food stamps. And there would be no more food stamps. There would be no more AFDIC Assistance to Families with Dependent Children, AFDC. But a lot of the welfare people that you would think would have supported the policy didn't. And you could say the same thing on the conservative side. You know, Bob Dole, for example, wanted to get rid of all sorts of welfare programs, but he didn't want to get rid of food stamps. Thought he loved food stamps. And one of the reasons he loved food stamps, of course, is he was from Kansas. And when you give out food stamps, you got to buy food with it. I think the divisiveness certainly affects policy, but I think more than important than that, it affects attitude. You know, when I graduated from college, and this is probably true of you too, I assumed that I would have a good job, and I got a decent job.
Yep.
My honors graduate daughter says to me that, well, you don't get a good job coming right out of college, Dad. So the world has changed and their attitudes have changed. And I wonder if they're willing to throw in to the pot the same as we were. You know what I mean? Even though the country was divided. I mean, I graduated from college in the 1970s. We were pretty divided in those days. But still, as a country, I think we had the attitude that it was better to be an American than anything else. If we worked together, we could make a better world. That we had to try to come together rather than be apart. And I'm not sure that's true anymore.
I just hope that the pendulum has done swinging and that we can get back to a more new normal that is less partisan and more American, if you will. And that we can work with our differences instead of I mean, here in California, the Democrats run everything. It's, you know, from the top down. In fact, we've got two Democrats running for, let's see, it's Kamala Harris, who's our Attorney General, and Loretta Sanchez, who is one of those Congress or Assembly. I'm sorry, I'm sounding ignorant.
Congress,
but they're both running for the same position. So it's going to be a Democrat. It's just which. And since Kamala Harris has gotten President Obama's endorsement, I'm sure it'll be her. Plus, her war chest is huge.
I mean, you know, you get that. And you could say that, you know, you could say that in places like Alaska and Utah for the Republicans, too. There are places where
but not as populated as California.
No. You know, that's the nature of partisan politics. And that's a whole nother discussion. You know, there are all sorts of people out there saying you're hearing it more and more that there shouldn't be, we should have nonpartisan elections. I don't necessarily believe in that, but I think that leads to a system where you know, it's like Italy, where you have 35 different parties trying to work together, and that never seems to work very well.
Well, ours came about because California changed everything and said instead of the top vote getter in each party, it's the two top vote getters, regardless of party. So that's why for Senate, we have only a Democrat to choose from, is because both of them got the most votes. And ironically, both women, of course, which is, you know, I'm really proud of California in so many ways because of how progressive we are. Including, you know, upping the minimum wage and all the things that we're doing. But I wonder if we're going to survive it.
Well, California is a great example of what we're talking about, I think, because you have sent us Richard Nixon and Jerry Brown. I mean, can you imagine two political candidates that were more different than those two candidates coming from the same state,
right?
You know, and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Pat Brown, and you know,
well,
I mean,
and Ronald Reagan and Gray Davis,
Gray Davis, exactly, Gray Davis and Ronald Reagan, you know, and that's a good thing, right? It's a good thing that you can get people that are so different coming from the same state, as opposed to the whole cookie cutter thing. And, you know, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say we had the same situation in Washington, D.C. You know, it's good to be a Democrat in Washington. When I win the primary, I then go out and give my wife and I go out and give cookies out and donuts out on Election Day, because nobody that's ever won the Democratic primary in the District of Columbia has ever lost the general election, because 3 out of every 4 voters in the District of Columbia is a Democrat. So yeah, it's one thing that we have to deal with, the partisanship, but the real problem is being so far apart, I think. And I think that makes this election very important. I think that more than anything, people need to get out there and vote. If you're not going to vote for one, a Republican or a Democrat, go vote for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein or Russell Hirschhorn. But let's let these guys know that we're keeping an eye on them and that we're concerned about the direction the country's going in, and that we're willing to change that direction. Because when less than 50% of the registered voters in America show up to vote, we're not sending that message. And so,
well, and along those lines, they say that Gary Johnson polled 8.4% and Jill Stein polled 3.2%, which that's why they're not being included in the debates, because the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates said the candidates have to get 15% in order to be considered a contestant, if you will. So,
well, nonpartisan commissions are an oxymoron in my opinion.
Are they?
You just can't have a nonpartisan commission.
Why do you say that?
Well, because I think everybody comes on with their own agenda. And the fact that you put 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats on a panel doesn't make it nonpartisan. just makes it confrontational. And I think they do. I think these guys do have their agendas, and that, you know, they pick this very carefully. You know how these debates go. They pick the locations very carefully. Mm-hmm. Can't do it in the South because that benefits one candidate. Can't do it in the West because that benefits another candidate. Got to do it at a university because you don't want to, if you do it at the ExxonMobil arena somewhere, it'll imply that the candidate's being endorsed by them. You know, I mean, every little thing in Washington, you know, is partisan. And let me tell you something, it's also my opinion, and this is my last word, that not voting is a partisan decision. So let's get out there and vote. And Maria, exactly, we're out of time. You got to say the last thing.
That no decision is a decision. No action is an action. And silence is, you're standing on the sidelines, sitting on your hands, then you don't have anything vested into the process, which means that then you have to accept what the rest of us do, because we do care.
Okay, America, we'll see you next week when I continue on my quest to make Maria Sanchez a Democrat. Thanks,
have a great
America.
Week, Michael.
Have a great week.
And to our you listeners, too, thank you for your time. Bye-bye.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.